This is Director Chris Rodriguez of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect NJOHSP's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in all these fields in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and to offer you a unique perspective on current homeland security trends and issues. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Hi, this is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. In February of 2017, a few of us went down to the International Studies Association Conference in Baltimore, Maryland, to talk to academics and practitioners on the subject of terrorism, homeland security, and intelligence. The series of podcasts you're going to hear are our first thoughts and first observations based on listening to those presentations. Good afternoon. This is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. And today I'm with Gary Ackerman. He's the director of the Unconventional Weapons and Technology Division at the University of Maryland's START, which is the Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. He manages large research projects here, explores new avenues of research, and establishes collaborative research relationships. Prior to taking up his current positions, Ackerman held the posts of Research Director and then Special Projects Director at START and the Director of the Center for Terrorism and Intelligence Studies, a private research and analysis institute. He has also served as the Director of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Research Program at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, California, and Chief of Operations of the South African-based African Asian Society. Ackerman possesses an eclectic academic background, including past studies in the fields of mathematics, history, law, and international relations. His research encompasses various areas relating to terrorism and counterterrorism, including terrorism threat assessments, motivations for using chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons, radicalization, the relationship between terrorism and technology, and the modeling and simulation of terrorist behavior. He is the co-editor of Jihadists and Weapons of Mass Destruction, author of several articles on chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear terrorism, and has testified on terrorist motivations for using nuclear weapons before the Senate Subcommittee on Homeland Security. So, thank you very much for joining us today. Can I call you Gary?
Yes, by all means. Excellent. I'm happy to be here, Dean.
Thank you very much. So I want to talk a little bit about your field of study in nuclear or biological terrorism. It's probably generally regarded as one of the ultimate nightmare scenarios for many counterterrorism experts around the world. Could you talk a little bit about what's the state of the threat currently with regard to biological or nuclear terrorism?
So yes, I'm happy to do so. I think before we even get started, it's useful to make a distinction about different types of especially biological terrorism and what nuclear terrorism actually is. When it comes to small-scale events, what I say very crude biological events, something like somebody, it seemed to be done, somebody with the flu sneezing onto a napkin and then rubbing it all over somebody else's doorknob, that's fairly easy to do, but that also doesn't have a very large public health impact or public safety impact. Likewise, radiological terrorism, which is usually small-scale radiological agents, doesn't include any kind of nuclear fission or fusion reaction. That's also much less of a public safety impact, although it still can have quite a bit. But when we're talking true nuclear weapons, a nuclear detonation or a very large-scale biological attack with a highly infectious, highly virulent agent, those are really the upper end of what we think terrorists could actually accomplish. These are events that would be catastrophic by anybody's imagining. They'd be true weapons of mass destruction events, and they would invariably dwarf 9/11 in magnitude. So those are the ones people are very, very concerned about. But we have to distinguish between those, because a lot of people, when they say biological, they don't specify, is it the very small crude biological or is it the very large scale mass biological attack? And sometimes people use nuclear when they really mean radiological. So the good news is, even though true nuclear and large scale biological are the sort of nightmare worst case scenarios, they're also amongst the most difficult of all terrorist attacks to carry out. So although they are the most consequential, conceivably, they're also sort of the least likely to be successfully carried out.
So I remember a number of years ago, there were a bunch of stories about biological warfare, biological terrorism, and the sort of cliche at the time was anybody with a undergraduate degree in biology is just a step away from biological terrorism. Was that some hyperbole at the time, or is... is that closer to the truth? What's your opinion on that?
So this goes back again to what I just said. So there definitely are people out there who would, groups and organizations, terrorists out there, extremists, who would love to use high-end biological weapons or nuclear weapons if they could get their hands on them. So the motivation side is definitely covered already, especially groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda Central, even some of the more fanatical right-wing, far-right organizations in the United States, or several apocalyptic millenarian cults. There are several groups out there who would like to. The trick is, are they capable of doing it? Now, somebody with an undergraduate degree in biology or physics could potentially put together a very crude attack, biological attack, but it's one of those attacks that may make one person slightly ill if they're very lucky. To do a very large-scale attack or any kind of a nuclear attack requires a lot of expertise, usually years of training, and is beyond the reach of anybody, certainly with a undergraduate or high school level education. However, and here's the big but, technology is progressing very rapidly. There are things happening, especially in the biotechnology world, where there are now new technologies, new equipment that can essentially synthesize and produce and disseminate biological agents are feasible with far less expertise, far less cost, far smaller footprint than ever before. Now, we're not quite at the stage where an undergraduate can launch a mass casualty biological weapon, or that's very unlikely at the moment. But the problem is that technology, every year, technology is making great bounds and leaps. And it is interesting, in New York, for instance, they're teaching high school students how to do genetic modification of plants and animals and insert genes into things. It's only a matter of time before the technology reaches a point that somebody with an undergraduate level education or even lower than undergraduate level education will be able to put together a large-scale serious bioweapon. When it comes to nuclear weapons, though, they're actually not that difficult to build. I mean, they're not that easy. It's not trivial by any means. But somebody with a standard engineering background and a physics background might be able to do it. The good news with nuclear weapons is that terrorists or other lone actors have to get their hands on the nuclear material. And that is still quite difficult to do, to get the right amounts of nuclear material in the right form that it can form a weapon. So, to cut a long story short, we're currently in the situation where it is unlikely that the run-of-the-mill terrorist is going to be able to launch a large-scale bio attack or a nuclear terrorist attack. But with technology changing, education levels changing, where people even in the least developed parts of the world can access the most technical levels of education through massive online courses, things like that, we are reaching a stage where it is becoming easier and easier for these groups to do it. Whether that will be in 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years, that's something that remains to be seen.
So you talked about some groups that would definitely like to use nuclear or biological weapons. In your research, is there anything that identifies a group for what makes it want to resort to use such weapons? Is there something about some of these groups that is sort of unique to them that makes them want to go to that level? And Are groups like that susceptible to deterrence, do you think?
Okay, so that's a good point. When you look at the motivations for these kinds of large-scale weapons, the first set of motivations can be ideological. So you can have an organization that believes that they need to kill many, many people or harm many, many people. And sometimes an organization that part of the ideology is that they have to do so to emulate, for instance, a biblical plague, which would put them, essentially drive them towards a biological weapon. Or another organization that might feel that they have to do it in one catastrophic, cataclysmic event, which would maybe drive them towards a nuclear weapon. So there are groups with ideologies that drive them to cause mass casualties. For instance, amongst the global Salafi jihadist groups, they have already had fatwas that they can use weapons of mass destruction and kill up to millions of Americans, that it's perfectly okay to do that. In fact, it's actually advocated by some of their theologians. So that's kind of one area, which is an ideological area, ideological driver. Another element of it is sort of less ideological, but what we call more fetishistic. These are individuals or organizations that have a predilection for certain technologies, especially high sophisticated technologies. And these are groups that are sort of fascinated by it, want to show themselves to be the masterminds. That's another thing that can drive them specifically into these agents. And there have been many cases historically of that. The third reason is for more strategic reasons, in that an organization that wants to be number one amongst its peers, that wants to get more attention than any other terrorist organization in history, wants to make sure its message gets out and wants to make sure that it gets support from its perceived constituencies, especially if that organization is in competition with other groups, might want to do something that's bigger than anything else to sort of differentiate themselves from the pack. Now, it's only in a certain I'd say narrow situations where a group would actually want to do this in terms of a nuclear or large-scale biological weapon because of the opportunity for losing the support of potential constituents or of their constituency's potential supporters. But there are groups out there, especially amongst the jihadist groups, who would view this as a way of differentiating themselves, as a way of establishing themselves as the true inheritor of jihad, that would be interested in that. But there's also potentially some other organizations that might want to differentiate themselves. So, for instance, organizations on the far right have often tried to model themselves after the exploits in the so-called Turner Diaries, and those included, for instance, use of nuclear weapons and attacks on nuclear power plants. So, this is something that some of these other groups might also be seeking. In terms of other elements that can drive an organization to pursue these weapons, but I think the key ones are a strategic desire to stand out from the rest and establish themselves as sort of the preeminent organization amongst their peers. I think an ideological desire or strategic desire to cause mass casualties that cannot be accomplished, to the extent that cannot be accomplished with other means, or some kind of psychological attachment to these particular weapons. Those are the main drivers.
Now, in modern history, are you aware of, have there been any successful biological, large-scale biological attacks?
There have been a series of smaller-scale biological attacks. Possibly the largest biological attack was perpetrated by a cult in Oregon called the Rajneeshis in the mid-1980s, and they sprayed salmonella onto a salad bars and made several hundred individuals ill intentionally. So that's probably the largest, at least in the United States. There have been Aum Shinrikyo, the Japanese apocalyptic millenarian cult. They attempted to use biological agents, but were never successful, but they had the intent to do so. We also know that several other organizations, amongst the jihadist organizations, have been interested in this, but none of them have ever got it off the ground. And then there have been several cases of, small-scale infections. But the Rajneeshis are probably the largest we've had specifically in the biological area. It is interesting, though, that in the 70s there was a group called RISE, which thought that they could use biological agents. They were a somewhat radical environmentalist group, thought they could use biological agents to wipe out the entire world, except for a couple of remaining breeding pairs, as they called them, which is something straight out of a James Bond movie. But they actually thought they could use them. They actually acquired biological agents. They just really didn't understand how to use them in a way that would cause even a handful of casualties. casualties. But there definitely has the motivation there, but we haven't seen much success so far.
And the Rajneesh cult you talked about in Oregon, they did that attack in order, if I remember right, to alter a local election. Is that correct?
Yes. So they were doing it for very instrumental reasons. They believed they wanted to take control of the local government, and they thought that if they brought in their own people and made enough of the other parts of the electorate ill, they wouldn't be able to vote. So what the salad bar was basically a trial run to see if they could actually pull this off, and they could, but they decided ultimately they didn't end up doing it. Two interesting things about that. They actually attempted to use biological agents on some other government officials previously by putting it in drinking in their sort of handed them glasses of drinking water. And it's also interesting that the only reason people found out about that attack was when one of the cult's members, a few years subsequent to the actual attack on the salad bar, actually spoke about the attack. Before then, it was just believed to be an unintentional foodborne disease outbreak.
So it's interesting. I mean, most people, I think, when they think of biological attacks, think of Ebola, the catastrophic, you know, huge mortality. But in fact, it can be used much more, I guess, subtly might be the right term. So in line with that, would we also include attacks that might destroy our food or water supply? Sort of, it's also been called like sort of agro-terrorism.
Yes.
Would that be considered here as well?
Yes, definitely. I mean, some of the most infectious agents are what are called animal agents or zoonotic agents on the biological side. And also current practices in agriculture often have a lot of concentration. So for instance, very large feedlots, very large sort of production farms, and it's very easy for diseases to spread. So something like foot and mouth disease, if that got loose, it could completely destroy various U.S. Cattle or other industries. And similar swine flu could destroy the pork industry. Those kinds of things could cause massive economic damage and large-scale disruption in certain parts of the country that depend on those kinds of industries and markets. The interesting thing is that there are several diseases that actually affect both animals and humans, and those could be used sort of for both purposes. Although I think the key idea about some of the concern about the threat is not so much what's happened already, but what could happen. Because if you get a so-called, quote-unquote, warfare agent or a biological weapon that's been used or considered for use in warfare before, those are highly virulent and they have high mortality rates. So we're thinking here about anthrax, about smallpox, about plague. Those have never really been used by terrorists, but if they were used by terrorists, except on very small cases like in the Amerithrax investigation or Amerithrax case, but if those were used, that is where a lot of the concern comes into, because those could cause really large amounts of casualties. So that's something we have to prevent and prepare for.
Just a couple of additional questions. Have we done anything right in terms of preparing for the eventuality of a nuclear or biological terrorist attack? Have we safeguard materials well, mitigation or recovery stance? What's your feeling on that?
So I think in the U.S. overall, I'd say we've done fairly well. So I think we've probably got a solid B-. Maybe a C+, a B-. So in some areas, we've secured facilities very well. Nuclear materials are probably more secure in the United States than they are anywhere else in the world. But on the other hand, a few years ago, septuagenarian, octogenarian group of Christian pacifists, including a former nun, broke into Y-12, which is supposedly the most secure nuclear facility in the world in the U.S., and got right up to where they house the nuclear materials. So for every one of every sort of measure, we have sort of counterexamples. In the biological side, we've done a lot of preparations. We now actually have large-scale biological sensors that are there to detect biological attacks early. We have some public health preparations, antibiotics, et cetera, et cetera. So we have some stockpiles. So we're much better than we were 15, 20 years ago. However, there are many sort of gaps in this, and there's sort of many areas where there's still weaknesses, where we still have problems with coordination, where we're not sure if we're stockpiling the right antibiotics for the right diseases, where, as I said, facilities show lapse in security. So I say we're on the right track, but none of the current systems are what I would call foolproof, and none of them are at the stage where I would say we should be complacent and rest on our laurels. I think we need to improve our systems, improve our surveillance systems, improve our intelligence systems, improve our emergency management preparedness systems for these agents. But we also have made a lot of progress in the last, since 9/11, the last 15 or so years.
And last question we ask everyone is, do you have any recommendations for people who may be interested in this topic a little more deeply, or just anything in general you'd like to recommend for them to read, watch, anything like that?
So I think there's some very interesting books, at least in terms of unconventional terrorism. I think that there's a book called Weapons of Mass Destruction, Terrorism, Science and Policy Choices, edited by Stephen Maurer, which provides a good introduction. I hate to recommend my own book, but if you're interested in specifically how jihadists intersect with weapons of mass destruction, that is an interesting edited volume. But I think there's also a couple of good websites out there. The Federation of American Scientists, FAS, has a lot of good materials in this area. So there's a lot of information out there. I think that there is, the important things to know about this is it's one of those threats that you need to pay attention to, because if it ever does manifest, it's a bad day for everybody. It's the worst case scenario. But at the same time, you have to sort of view it without exaggerating the threat and at the expense of more prosaic but likely threats. So I'd say this is something that has to be considered by law enforcement emergency preparedness, but it has to be considered alongside and in the context of, you know, various conventional forms of attack and various other sort of natural public health emergencies. I think one of the best things we can do is to create dual use preparedness. You know, generally it's best to keep dangerous materials out of the hands of dangerous people, whether those people are terrorists, criminals, or just a disgruntled employee. At the same time, it's generally better to be prepared for any public health outbreak, whether it's a new emerging disease like SARS or the MERS virus, or whether it's a bioterrorist attack. If we prepare dual use responses, sort of all hazards response, I think we'll be in the long run better off to deal with any new threats that might emerge.
Great. Gary, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
No problem at all. My pleasure.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.